People often mistake the spirit of resistance. They see it as anger and hatred, and imagine its taste to be bitter. But resistance is founded in love. We find some things so beautiful and love them so deeply, so urgently, that when we identify systemic oppression that endangers them, we must resist. People often misjudge this motivation and feel it's a personal attack on them as individuals. But resistance is not something to be feared or to hold disdain for. Resistance is a passionate movement for the preservation of beauty. Resistance is a passionate movement for the preservation of beauty.
Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Burst of Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California. This show is brought to you by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm features organic coffee and milks, vegan sandwiches, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found online at firestormcafe.com. This week's show features two portions. The first we're presenting is a speech from the recent Carborough Anarchist Book Fair by a collective member of Untarelli Press on queer resistance inside and outside of prisons in the 20th centuries in the United States, and what we might take from the experiences of our predecessors. More from Untarelli can be found at untorellipress.noblogs.org. Secondly, we'll hear a presentation by Joe of the North American Anarchist Black Cross Medical Justice Committee. The conversation ranges over a number of topics, but focuses primarily on active and revolutionary solidarity with anarchist and other political prisoners. At this point, it's good to make a few notes. Because of the nature of the conversations on this episode, dealing with bashings and prisons and police and rape and other horrible things, I'd like to give a trigger warning. Also, the views expressed in these conversations are not necessarily those of The Final Straw, Asheville FM, KWTF, or KXCF, or something.
Hi. I'm going to do a talk about the history of queer revolt against prisons and police. I should offer a trigger warning because there's going to be discussion of like sexual violence and gender violence and gay bashing and such. So if you want, you can leave at any point or anything. So, to begin, I'm going to talk a bit about gay organizing and revolt pre-Stonewall. Most of this is characterized by spontaneous uprisings against police persecution. These kind of, by spontaneous, I don't mean that they just came out of nowhere, but they were rooted in informal networks of street queens, sex workers, young fags, and hustlers. The networks were mostly focused around survival, sharing resources and money, sharing tips for hustling, housing, self-defense. And they sprang from conflictual zones in cities. These were metropolitan neighborhoods where social tolerance for sexual difference was high and police interference with life was low or non-existent. Some examples of this are the Cooper's Donuts riots in Los Angeles in 1959, where police, when they attempted to arrest some queens and hustlers, were met with revolt. The queers resisted, threw trash and pastries at police, danced on cars, and lit fires. Another example of this is the Compton's Cafeteria riots, which took place at a popular hangout for queens and hustlers, when the owners called the police and they tried to arrest a queen. She threw hot coffee in the pig's face, and this caused the other patrons to break dishes and furniture, smash out windows, and burn down a nearby newsstand. And the next night, the Compton's Cafeteria was picketed again, and the windows were again smashed. So this is one element of gay life pre-Stonewall. The other is the more assimilationist homophile organizations. They were like suit and tie kind of things. They would attempt to protest what they saw as like civil rights violations. But even despite this, they still engaged in some like community self-defense against police. The Mattachine Society did things like print wallet cards for gay men titled "What to Do in Case of Arrest." And this will be very different from what we'll see later on with these assimilationist elements. So things take a turn in June 1969 in New York City with the Stonewall Riots, where a routine police raid on a mafia-owned gay bar, the Stonewall Inn, turned into a confrontation with angry queens, street kids, dykes, and fags attacking the police after they attempted to arrest a butch dyke. The street kids and queens started to throw coins, garbage cans, and bottles at police, trapping them in the bar. They then uprooted a parking meter and used it as a battering ram against the door of the bar. They wanted to burn down the bar with the police in it, but the cops unfortunately escaped. And the next few days were filled with open rebellion in the streets, including graffiti, leafleting, street fights with the tactical police force, and the destruction of police cars. And this marked a turning point for many gays where everyone, from the street queens to those in the homophile organizations, turned towards a different, more revolutionary trajectory, where police were seen as foot soldiers of a straight capitalist world and were seen as the enemy. And this can be seen post-Stonewall with the rise of the gay liberation movement, which modeled itself after third world, black liberation, women's liberation struggles. It was often very distinctly anti-capitalist and anti-authoritarian. Some things that happened there related to police and prisons were the proliferation of these anti-prison marches, or just generally taking gay liberation front marches and doing things like marching them past prisons. A march on August 29th, 1970 purposefully passed the Women's House of Detention, where Joan Byrd and Afeni Shakur, two members of the Panther 21, were being held. The Women's House of Detention also often housed lesbians from nearby gay neighborhoods, so it was a visible structure of gay oppression. During this march, Gay Liberation Front members yelled things like, "Free our sisters, free ourselves," and the prisoners yelled back and dropped burning pieces of paper in solidarity. This same march came upon a gay club being raided by the police, and a riot ensued with people throwing bottles at police, looting stores, flipping cars, and setting fires. On the other end of this, there is more formal solidarity projects that were started. In these, gay prisoners were seen as brothers and sisters. Things that happened included publishing newsletters, reporting on and investigating prison conditions, giving legal aid, creating pen pal projects, and assisting with parole. And the logic behind them was one that any gay person, due to homophobic police repression, could be in jail at any time. Things like the gay liberation newspaper Gay Sunshine in 1972 proclaimed, "We are all fugitives." Gay liberationist Ellen Young, who wrote an important collection called Out of the Closets, wrote in the introduction to that all gay prisoners are political prisoners. So there was not just a dialogue between gay people in prison and gay people on the outside, but an identification. This is incredibly apparent in the group STAR. They were a collective of street queens that came about in the year after Stonewall. They were formed by Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson. And unlike most of the Gay Liberation Front, which found its origins in homophile organizations or more specific political affiliations, STAR sprang from those earlier informal networks of street queens and sex workers. They were heavily focused on solidarity and mutual aid, as well as lived criminality and hatred for the police. The group started in 1970 after an occupation of NYU's Weinstein Hall. The hall refused to allow gay dances, and gay liberationists occupied the building, but left after the tactical police force came. STAR, which was then called Street Transvestites for Gay Power, was intensely frustrated with the gay liberation movement's refusal in that instance to confront the police. So they came about after that. They organized with the Gay Liberation Front. They also organized with groups like the Young Lords. They were very rooted in survival, the self-organized living spaces, first as a common practice by renting out hotel rooms and sharing them with other street queens and sex workers who were working at any given night. Later on, they rented a trailer truck, and after that formed Star House. In each of these instances, Marsha and Sylvia hustled on the street in order to save money and pay the rent so the young kids didn't have to. And in turn, the kids would do things like steal food. The project was short-lived, but in an interview with Marsha, she said she hoped to create a phone line for prisoners, a bail fund for arrested queens, and attempt to secure legal help for people in prison. So as the gay liberation movement progressed, there became fault lines developing. And in 1973, these became very apparent. The two sides of this were things like street queens, queers of color, poor people, and people with more radical political lines versus these more assimilationist, white, middle-class elements. And with a political management by these movement leaders, these assimilationists developing, groups like the Mattachine Society and Gay Activist Alliance did things like hold lectures on gay issues for people training to be prison guards. And there was a move away from a revolutionary ethic and towards a more civil rights framework. And that meant the abandonment of an anti-police or anti-prison line. The meetings for groups like Gay Activist Alliance became battlegrounds. Martin Duberman, in his book Stonewall, recalls that for Sylvia, that people, quote, if someone was not shunning her dark skin or sniggering at her passionate, fractured English, they were deploring her rude anarchism as inimical to order and denouncing her sashaying ways as offensive to womanhood. So there are these different elements that are coming against people like Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson. And at the Christopher Street Liberation Day Parade in 1973, these came to a head. The Christopher Street Liberation Day Parade is now called Gay Pride in its depoliticized form, and it just marks the anniversary of Stonewall. During this, Sylvia was barred from the stage by gay men and attacked by a group calling themselves Lesbian Feminist Liberation for parodying womanhood. When she fought her way on stage, she started berating the audience for not supporting people in jail, which Starr had been doing heavily, and decried them as a white, middle-class, white club that ignored prisoners and street queens. So as the gay liberation movement moves into the mid to late 70s and into the 80s, there are still some formal projects that are maintained against prison. These are mostly publications and material support. The Radical Fairy magazine, RFD, began its Brothers Behind Bars section in 1975, which sought to bring together what they called victims of injustice, people in prison, and potential victims, people outside of prison. Mike Regal began Gay Community News's Prison Project in 1975, which connected gay imprisonment with general analysis of social control and homophobia in society. And because of these projects, there was some evidence of gay liberation ideas spreading in prison.
This is The Final Straw on Asheville FM, KXCF, and KWTF. A hearty welcome to listeners at PWR Radio in Austin, Texas, WRFU in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and the pirate station at the ZAD in France, the land occupation. We're hearing a member of Unterelli Press speaking about some history of queer resistance in the 20th century in the U.S. inside and outside of prison. This audio was recorded at the 2013 Carrboro, North Carolina Anarchist Book Fair. You've just heard a member of Unterelli Press speaking about some history of queer resistance in the 20th century in the U.S. inside and outside of prison. This audio was recorded at the Carrboro, North Carolina Anarchist Book Fair in November of 2013. More on that project can be found at Unterelli Press, that's UNTORELLI, press.noblogs.org.
On the other end of the spectrum of like solidarity in the late 70s, there was overt attack and guerrilla warfare against these structures. A group called the George Jackson Brigade was an urban guerrilla group that attacked structures in and around Seattle from 1975 to 1978. They did things like carry out armed robberies, liberate prisoners, bomb specific targets in solidarity with prison struggle and native struggle and black struggle. They did things like bomb the Department of Corrections, an FBI office, a bank, financiers of a paper, a power and light substation, generally in solidarity with these struggles. And they also differed from many of the other guerrilla groups of the time, like the Weather Underground or the Red Army faction, in that they were multiracial. There were multiple ex-cons in the group. They came from different classes. There were gay and lesbian and bisexual members, and there were anarchists and Marxist-Leninists in the group. One member of the group, Ed Mead, was arrested for brigade actions and was sent to Walla Walla prison. There he was met with a situation in which there was a lot of predatory inmates preying on weaker or effeminate inmates, and also a lot of rape and pimping of those people. So he started a group called Men Against Sexism, which was structured to create a situation of self-defense for those prisoners. They did things like take part in existing prison revolts in the prison, but also did things like violent self-defense and retaliation against predatory inmates, and created a situation of warfare against rape and sexual slavery in the prison. They created safe cells, disrupted anti-gay sermons, spread feminist and gay liberation ideas amongst the prisoners, protected weaker inmates and new inmates, and stockpiled weapons, including homemade guns and hand grenades. And it was a sort of two-pronged defense and attack against both the prison authorities and rapists in the prison. And I think that George Jackson Brigade in Men Against Sexism is important because it shows a more confrontational, direct approach to prison solidarity. Members of the brigade, such as Ed Mead and Bo Brown, had connections to the gay liberation movement, but took these politics towards warfare, inspired by their own lives as ex-cons and anarchist and communist revolutionaries, rather than the civil rights framework favored by much of the gay liberation movement. The last thing that I will bring up is the White Night Riots, which share some similarities with things like Stonewall and the Compton's Cafeteria Riots, in that it was a widespread like rioting in response to police violence and the machinations of the state. After Dan White was acquitted of his assassination of Harvey Milk, riots happened in San Francisco, with people burning numerous police cars and smashing out the windows of City Hall. So, as things move into the 80s, more problems develop even within these projects of solidarity. There is a wider disconnect between the white civil rights gaze and the more liberationist-minded radical people doing the prison support work. But even within that more radical contingent, there are breaks between people on the outside and people on the inside. Ideas about gender, such as the butch femme dichotomy and people's presentation as queens, were seen as like primitive or oppressive by many of the people doing the prison support work. And within this, like, feminized homosexuality was seen as an impediment to gay freedom. An Illinois prisoner criticized the Join Hands newsletter, which was a newsletter to gay prisoners, saying, "All you brothers and sisters out there, why don't you give the queens a break? It's hard enough on us being put down by the straights." So this, like, plays into a wider disidentification between queers on the outside and people in prison, where once gays saw prison as a possible or likely future, they now joined in the straight world's condemnation of prisoners. Some tactics that were used with this were like questioning whether prisoners receiving support were actually gay or condemning them as criminals. One person wrote in a letter to the editor to Gay Community News, which had continued doing prison support, saying she was tired of seeing letters bitching about how terrible prison is. They should have thought about that before they committed a crime. So this kind of like white middle-class gay assimilationism distances itself as much as possible from the reality of prison. And with some exceptions, such as like ACT UP and these more radical queer elements in the 90s, this tension continues now, with the AIDS crisis wiping out many of the like most radical members of the gay liberation movement. We are left with a very overpowering like white middle-class assimilationist structure that we have to fight against. So I present this all not as a way to just historicize. I believe that history is important, but it is also used against us. We can often exceptionalize the past, see it as something distant from us, something that we can't engage with in the same way. History is also a way that society recuperates queer revolt. Obama referenced Stonewall in a speech not too long ago. There are also professionals and careerists in academia and the art world who take these images and writings by dead queers and use their social power now to denounce contemporary queer revolt. So our struggle as queers who want to destroy society is against society, but also against its false critics. I only have some suggestions. I do not have answers. So some things that would be important to keep in mind are understanding what is positive in the informal queer revolt of the past and the more formal projects of prison solidarity. Some of the pre-Stonewall gay revolt has a lot of parallels to insurrectionary anarchist ideas such as autonomy, self-organization, informality, and criminal rather than political affiliation. And now more than ever, with diffuse power structures, these methodologies offer us ways outside of the failure of formal organizations and open up experimentations for new forms of revolt. And we should also consider the way we frame prison solidarity and attempt to create a resurgence of that identification with people in prison, attempts to demolish the borders between the prison and the outside. If we understand that we are struggling as criminals against society, then the division between us on the outside and people in prison is non-existent. We could be in prison at any time, and we need to understand our solidarity in light of that fact. Though the failures of guerrilla struggle are numerous and apparent, we can also learn from groups like the George Jackson Brigade, which opted for direct attack on structures of domination rather than civil rights framework. And we also have to be concerned to and make sure we refuse things like the non-profit organization, academia, the art world, and professional activism as dead ends that end in either recuperation of struggle or the creation of new gay politicians that will stifle uncontrollability. So what we can do is practice revolutionary solidarity. This means not just material support for people in prison, but also the continuation of revolt as our way of building solidarity. We can also build connections with gay people and queer people and trans people struggling in prison who are fighting against both prison authorities and homophobic and predatory inmates. An example of this is the group Gender Anarchy in California. And just generally not forgetting people in prison, focusing very heavily on trying to build those relationships and do what we can to support struggle in prison. And most importantly, and to finish, every week we hear of new gay bashings, new murders, new arrests, and new atrocities committed against people in prison and also people on the outside. It is obvious that the time for waiting has finished. It is long past, and we can't keep begging the world to stop kicking in our teeth. Queers in revolt must sustain antagonism against the existent, never ceasing or compromising in our struggle, unless we wish for queerness to mean anything but a new face for this miserable world. And if in this world only revolt gives us space to breathe, let us begin to breathe together.
Woo! So.
Welcome back to The Final Straw. Let's take a quick musical break. FM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursts. Now let's hear from Joe of the North American Anarchist Black Cross Medical Justice Committee to talk about the recent call-out by that group denouncing the U.S. government's treatment of political prisoners in need of medical attention and care. This conversation ranges over a number of topics, but focuses primarily on active and revolutionary solidarity with anarchists and other political prisoners. We're speaking with Joseph Jordan of the North American Anarchist Black Cross Medical Justice Committee about the recent statement by that group about the treatment of political prisoners in the United States. Thanks a lot for talking to me.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Just as a point of clarification, is the North American Anarchist Black Cross part of the Federation or the network or independent of both?
It's its own thing. Like the Federation existed for a while, for better and worse. I believe it still has some chapters that are part of the Federation, but you know, as an anarchist, like I'm me. I'm my own Anarchist Black Cross. Other people can just be their own Anarchist Black Cross. It's like the ALF or ELF, like that. You know, just by doing the work, you can identify it. So, like, the Federation is part of a group of people that have a constitution and have certain, like, things that they go by as to be part of said Federation. This is just a bunch of us that got together, united as the North American Anarchist Black Cross Medical Justice Committee, and are trying to do this work for this particular project.
First off, what's your definition of a political prisoner?
I don't know the committee. I can't speak for the committee. I'm not a communist. I'll speak for me as a member of the committee. Definition of a political prisoner is someone who is incarcerated for their beliefs. Like usually their anti-state, like, you know, anti-oppressive beliefs, or they're unduly, harshly sentenced or punished or repressed because of those beliefs. Not to be confused with a prisoner of war. I primarily support prisoners of war. Those are people who are incarcerated for taking up arms against the state, or in some way, like, engaging tactically against the state.
And what's the official government line in the U.S. on the existence of political prisoners within its borders, and what do you think about it?
Well, I think it's bullshit, and the official stance is that there are no political prisoners. I believe Andrew Young, who was, you know, rapporteur to the U.N. or something back in, like, 71 or whatever, was the, you know, acknowledged the existence of political prisoners within U.S. borders, and for that, he was compelled to resign. Since then, I don't know that there's been any kind of acknowledgement that there are political prisoners, because any kind of resistance is criminalized. So the U.S. practices indirect fascism as opposed to direct fascism. So instead of just, like, executing people in the streets for being dissidents, the government would never, or the U.S. government would never do that. It finds some, like, way to criminalize their very legitimate resistance efforts and then therefore incarcerates them for a crime. So everyone who's incarcerated has broken the law, whether or not the law is legitimate. Or they actually, you know, like, that's never questioned. So it's just like, they broke the law, they are not a political prisoner, they're just a criminal. And I think that's terrible, but, like, it's understandably strategic from their perspective. You know, they have to allow for some appearance of dissent in order to keep the issue running and to masquerade as, like, this bastion of freedom globally. You know, if you don't use their channels and their own checks and balances to address any issues you might have with the government, and you, like, take up arms yourself as an oppressed people or in solidarity with oppressed people and try to liberate yourself through your own means, through self-determination, through autonomous action and sometimes warfare, you're just reduced to a criminal. Even though the UN General Assemblies, I believe it's the 25th and the 28th, outline pretty clearly what an oppressed peoples, colonized peoples, victims of racist and alien regimes are, and it's justified that said victims and survivors take up arms against the oppressive regime to achieve self-determination. So internationally, the actions of these people and the formations they come from and the colonized nations within the U.S. borders that they come from are recognized as people who have the right to self-determination and, if necessary, like, violent means, any means necessary, any foreseeable means to liberate themselves. They're acknowledged to be such internationally, but good luck getting the international body to do a damn thing about it, to compel the U.S. to treat people as such. Like me, I have Celtic and New African blood. I identify as New African in this country. And the New African people are colonized people living under third world conditions within a first world superpower. And that's not acknowledged ever. The New African nation was never given the option of repatriation to Africa, never given the option of its own plebiscite or independent homeland within the U.S. borders, borders whose riches were very much made possible by the uncompensated labor, exploitation, and genocide of my people. And we weren't given the option of actively opting into the U.S. so-called democratic system. So it was just imposed on us. Citizenship was just imposed on us, and participation in this just imposed on us. So, you know, we're a scattered nation in exile, but that's not recognized by the U.S. And even if it is recognized internationally or by specific people within the U.S. and within the international community, like, you know, nothing can be done about it unless this government is somehow compelled with force, economic or otherwise, to recognize it. There's a ton of political prisoners, people who recognize that the earth itself has rights, people who recognize that the animal nations are sentient beings with the right to self-determination, and people who, like, are willing to commit acts of economic sabotage, direct action, or even, like, guerrilla warfare to achieve, like, the liberation of the earth and of the animal nations. They're considered just criminals. People who want American Indian or First Nations or Indigenous, whatever the particular, you know, individuals involved wish to identify as, people who want their liberation on their own homeland from which they've been exterminated, they're incarcerated and just considered criminals. You know, the list goes on and on.
It seems like it would be pretty unrealistic to expect the state to recognize its foundations on genocide and try to make any sort of reparations in any real sense for that. Because it would be self-abolition for the government, and that's something that's impossible for a nation state.
Of course. And if you also look at prison culture, like this whole country is founded on prison culture, the idea of oppression and compulsion and domination, not in any way kind of cooperation or compassion, but just like control and competition. And like the whole situation, like medical justice being a thing, I watched a documentary the other night on trans prisoners and like the efforts to achieve medical justice like within the trans community, and how so many people are denied necessary treatment and gender reassignment surgery, not only because, you know, the economic bottom line rules all and people are allowed to die of very easily dealt with illnesses because that would cost the government an extra penny that they could otherwise retain in profit. You know, a lot of the times people won't get medical care because it's seen as weakness. You know, it's like, though political prisoners and prisoners of war are not acknowledged to be such, they're very much treated like people on the other end of a war, where it's like, oh my God, if they ask for an apple and we give them an apple, well, tomorrow someone else will ask for an apple, so no one gets any apples. You know, and like, it is that simple and that petty. And to provide any concession, anything, to do anything for anyone is considered a weakness, and it will set precedent. Oh my God, if this person's like act of self-liberation or community liberation is like legitimized, oh my God, well then I guess a bunch of people will start like liberating themselves, so we have to just punish it as harshly as possible, demonize it, vilify it as harshly as possible, and make sure that no one would even think about asserting their self-determination in any way for their community or for themselves as an individual or for the voiceless like the animals and the earth.
Welcome back to The Final Straw. Let's take a quick musical break.
If you spit in my face and smack me in the mouth and throw me in solitary confinement for nothing, what do you think's going to happen when I get out of here?
We've just been hearing Joe from the North American Anarchist Black Cross Medical Justice Committee. They've been talking about the recent call-out by that group denouncing the U.S. government's treatment of political prisoners in need of medical care. A link on our blog at Asheville FM and later thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org to the statement and contact information for the NAABCMJC. That's a mouthful. So it's been about a month and a half since the death of Herman Wallace, who died barely 3 days after being released from prison. Can you talk about some of the other prisoners who were terminally ill and incarcerated that you're trying to bring attention to?
Well, Lynn Stewart is terminally ill, and I'm sure, you know, there's myriad resources where one can find out about Lynn Stewart. She's a, you know, white North American anti-imperialist who was a lawyer, and because of her defense of her client, basically publicizing some press releases and giving voice to someone who there was like a gag order on because he's a big bad terrorist. For that, they sentenced her when they knew she had cancer. And then when she said that it was doable, the sentence, that she could do the sentence standing on her head, they were like, all right, I'll give you 10 years. And to give like a woman in her 70s with stage 4 cancer 10 years, I mean, you know that that's an indirect death sentence in keeping with the indirect methods of fascism that the government employs. There's, in terms of terminal, offhand, I can't think of terminal. I can tell you there's people like riding the cusp, like Oso Blanco, you know, state name Byron Shane Chubuck, Cherokee warrior name Yona Onega. He may have liver cancer. He definitely has some kind of like situation going on, a mass in his liver. We had to like fight tooth and nail just to get him some semblance of treatment. They took his blood and they still refused to provide him with a proper ultrasound. And this man, up until very recently, was under SMU special management unit conditions. And they're some of the most restrictive conditions in the world. And like, if he's and then let's say he does, unfortunately, like worst case scenario, if he did have cancer, some, you know, not, he's Cherokee. He comes from a tradition of people that are holistic medicine practitioners, as is Leonard Peltier, who has a host of, you know, ailments. And, you know, African political prisoners, new African political prisoners also come from tribal nations that have had a relationship to the earth that isn't this combative relationship, this like very sick and destructive relationship. So they believe health is being able to let your body do its own thing and regulate itself, which means you need access to clean water, you need access to fresh air, you need access to vitamin D from the sun and other spiritual healing properties from the sun. You need access to herbs, fresh herbs, raw garlic, dandelion, any number of things. In the indirect killing of our people, the prison denies them any kind of healthful food. All they get is basically sodium-heavy, salt-heavy processed foods that's actually making it harder for the body to heal itself. They get contaminated water. The water in Florence is clearly contaminated and very close to nuclear testing sites. People go to Florence. They start getting vomiting, dizziness, diarrhea when they leave Florence because they're going to trial or whatever in other counties. They end up healing. And then they go back to Florence, the nausea comes back. Who's doing investigations into the quality of the water and food that these prisoners are getting, you know? It's like, it's that. Abdul Majid, Black Liberation Army soldier, Republic of New Africa soldier, has been unable to walk because of pressure on his sciatic nerve. He has sciatica. So because of that, we had to do like a huge call-in campaign just to get him surgery. And that was like last month, early last month. As of this month, he's supposed to, according to his mother a week ago, supposed to get surgery at some point this month. No date, nothing definitive. And until then, because he can't fucking walk, that means all they do is they deny him visitation and phone privilege because he can't walk to the fucking visiting room and he can't walk to the phone. They gave him the cane. His cane is not adjustable because that's not allowed in prison. So they gave him a cane that's too small. So for him to use this cane, he has to bend over in an uncomfortable manner, thus putting more pressure on the sciatic nerve that prevents him from walking in the first place. I mean, granted, he's not terminal, but this is still torture. I know that Chelsea Manning and members of the Gender Anarchy Formation have not been able to get like adequate gender reassignment treatment. A lot of prisons don't even acknowledge gender dysphoria disorder, which is a terrible fucking name for just being a trans individual. They don't recognize that as a legitimate condition, and therefore people commit self-treatment, aka cut their own genitals off with razors because they're denied medical treatment. You know, that's not terminal, but fuck that. Jaleel Mundakeen, another BLA soldier, he had a stroke in February, and it wasn't even realized until he was examined in May. And like that, like, you know, the brain damage that was done, who knows what could have been done if it was caught earlier. Robert Seth Hayes, another Black Liberation Army soldier, for years, since the 90s, has been dealing with getting adequate medication for his blood sugar and an adequate diet. And that has resulted in myriad instances of him falling into, like, comas, him passing out, him having to be hospitalized. When he had his blood sugar drop by hundreds of points, he ended up having a seizure, and all they did was throw him in the hole and construe his seizure as an attempt to assault an officer pig. And, I mean, that's not terminal, but it's still something. The Jewish Shakur had a stroke. You know, are they, like, any number of these aging prisoners just fall prey to issues that plague our community, even if these people aren't in cages for 23, 24 hours a day. You know, it's not terminal, but it's torture. It's recognized internationally as torture, and it's hastening the death of these people. You know, Merle Africa of the Move 9 died under extremely suspicious circumstances, in prison. Like, you know, she had what they called a stomach virus for 2 weeks. The MOVE members were feeding her, giving her adequate treatment. And then they say that MOVE people can't see her within the cages. They take her away to another cell. She dies in 2 days. And no one gets to see reports as to why. Like, these are the situations that go on, like, just because there's a political prisoner support community and a prisoner of war support community do we find out about these things. I can't imagine what type of issue goes on for social prisoners, as you call them, like, who, you know, don't have people, you know, kind of overseeing the prison and what the prison tries to get away with. I don't understand the concept of a social prisoner, like why the word is social.
Well, the reason that I brought that up is because there's a lot of questions about the usefulness of determining some prisoners to be political prisoners versus others to not be political prisoners based on...
Yeah, and I don't know why the word social particularly is used, but I'm a big proponent of distinguishing between political prisoners and prisoners of war. I mean, prison is an inherently political condition, but it's already hard enough to get a lot of supposed liberal anarchists when they can get around to actually, you know, paying lip service to the movement and write a goddamn letter to somebody who was willing to sacrifice their life to engage pigs tactically or to, like, you know, undertake any number of other actions that, you know, will sacrifice their freedom for this movement. Do you know how bad it would be if every prisoner is now recognized as a political prisoner and how much that would diffuse the already very paltry support we have for people who got sent to prison because they were fighting on the side of our movement? We have soldiers, soldiers fight for money or conscription. Warriors fight out of conscience. So we have warriors who are locked up. And, you know, there's people like Mumia Abu-Jamal, like, you know, he, for all intents and purposes, is innocent, was a MOVE supporter, was an intense, like, you know, journalist. He's a political prisoner because he didn't really kill that pig. I really don't think he killed that pig. All evidence points to the fact he did not kill that pig, but he's incarcerated because the state strategically wants to take him out of the community because him in the community is a danger to the state. There's political prisoners. I mainly deal with prisoners of war. There's Oso Blanco. You know, there's Casey Brezik, who is little known but was an anarchist, and whether or not he fought through his action completely, was willing to put his life on the line to take out the governor because he recognized that's what had to be done. There's Walter Bond, who everyone's turned their back on. He's the ALF lone wolf. He went underground to be a warrior for animal liberation, and he's been denounced because he's a bit of a prick. And he did, you know, and because he said some things that people don't like. But this man was actually willing to do something. Anarchists nowadays are just hipsters who do nothing other than, like, make money off of books, like working in nonprofits. Anarchism used to mean that you were feared. Louis Ling blew his own face up in suicide in prison after being locked up for attempted assassination. It wrote "Long Live Anarchy" in blood on the wall. I'm not being a anarchist and saying that we have to go to these extremes, but I'll be goddamned if the ideology that brought me out of right-wing craziness is watered down to be yet another hipster fashion trend and some ironic way to make money within this society. If people want to support our warriors behind the walls, give as much money as you spend on goddamn PBR to someone who's locked up for trying to make this world a better place.
Welcome back to The Final Straw. Let's take a quick musical break. So the call out is basically to get more support for these prisoners.
War in the streets and support for the prisoners. If you're above ground, spend your money supporting the prisoners, like, write to prisoners, get more militant. Listen to what they say. Like, there are elders, a lot of them, and if they're not our elders, they're our comrades. They have good shit to say, and they were, like, at the front line. Why not forge personal relationships with these folk behind the walls and, like, learn from them? Learn from them, ease their pain, send them food packages, go visit them. If you have to relocate to go visit one, do that. You know, like there's a lot more important things than going to grad school and joining a nonprofit. There needs to be a line in the sand between abolition and reform for anarchists. It's what separates us from liberals. Prison is genocide. It's concentration camps. Gentrification is genocide. The university and nonprofit industrial complexes are, like, parts of the system's chess game, they often do more damage to communities of color and low-income communities in the major cities than Nazis can. So, of course, like, Nazis will never really get a foothold in, like, the red states and, like, the places where the Klan still has clout. We need to be meeting them with violent opposition. But in terms of places like New York City, Brooklyn specifically, like Denver here, anywhere where there's a major city, we need to not only be fighting the Nazis, but fighting the indirect liberal Nazis. Like, white supremacy is not just hatred. It's also fetishizing, tokenizing, invisibilizing, assimilation. White saviorism is a big one. We need to combat all these things. We need to acknowledge that, like, by going to the university and being neutralized, and, like, a white kid getting paid to teach black and brown kids behind prison how to speak like a white man, that's not progress. Joining a nonprofit that's going to find a way to make money off of homelessness or prison, that's not a way to fix anything. If anything, the conservative beats the shit out of you and leaves you dying in the street, the liberal finds a way to take the money out your pockets as you lay there bleeding. Like Amazon of Gender Anarchy, who I think is awesome, and is an anarcho-nihilist, says, you know, the state is just like one tool of oppression. We need to smash this whole issue. And as an Afro-nihilist, as somebody who's, like, this system is based on the bloodshed, the rape and the murder and the exploitation of my black and brown ancestors. I also have some Cherokee ancestry, but I don't say that because every cracker in the world is a 1/16th Cherokee and uses it to justify their racism within the movement. But this system was founded on the murder of black and brown people. So therefore, anything that comes out of this system is rotten. If anything beautiful is to grow, this whole civilization needs to be destroyed if the animal nations are to have any kind of autonomy anymore, and if the earth is to not be a complete garbage can, this whole system needs to be burnt to the ground.
It's probably the best definition of nihilism that I've heard. Thank you. Like,
really?
Honestly, yeah.
Cool.
I mean, verbally.
That's what's up.
So.
That's what's up.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, I mean, if the medical, like, this is me, Joe, if the Medical Justice Committee doesn't like it, you know, they can ask me to not be the spokesperson anymore, but I just really can't give a fuck.
So we've strayed pretty far away from the Medical Justice Committee statement, I think.
Basically, if you're going to pick targets, big scale targets, like, you know, if there's ways to find, like, to like, do home demos, make, like, people involved in, like, you know, police and prison guards uncomfortable, that's a way to fight people in a prison abolitionist way, to attack the people who put people in prison. But for medical justice, for people who are in prison already, the Patrolman's Benevolent Association, the Fraternal Order of Police, the Bureau of Prisons, these are the institutions that are responsible for stymieing efforts at getting people to see the political struggle of those incarcerated and stymieing efforts to have people generate compassion for them. You know, the same people who tried to get Herman Wallace, like, on trial again to see if they could put him back in solitary, because to, like, let this man who's been incarcerated for 41 years in solitary die outside of a cage is far too compassionate for these monsters. You know, those people, we got to target. We got to target by calling them, like, jamming their phones, letter-writing campaigns to them, above-ground letter-writing campaigns being, like, pretty pleased with sugar on top. Let these people with cancer who fought for black human rights die outside of a cage. We need to find ways to get them, you know, in other ways. Take that to mean what the few mean. But these are the targets that need to be hit. And on the state level, the Board of Parole. So the Federal Bureau of Prisons, the Board of Pardons, you know, the executive clemency area, they need to be buttered up, you know, and attacking the Fraternal Order of Police, the Patrolman's Benevolent Association, trying to both butter up and attack the parole boards of various states, investigating who's on these boards, what's their connection to law enforcement.
So I think the FOP is a thing only on the East Coast, or at least it's not a thing in California where I grew up. Can you talk about what other institutions there'd be?
I don't know. Like, that's the thing. I'm real regional. I'm sure there's an equivalent, but there's some, like, think tank body that supports police and that usually criminalizes and fights efforts at parole for people who have righteously killed pigs. So, or I've been accused of it, because a lot of BLA soldiers and you know, Black Panther Party members didn't kill police. They may not have killed those police. They may not have killed police at all, and there are some that did kill police. Either way, they're all lumped in the same thing to be taken out of the movement. Finding, like, prison profiteers, and hitting them with boycotts or hitting individuals who profit from them in certain ways. Like, there's ways that you can, that we as a community, as a militant community, can make it hard for them to proceed with this bloody business as usual, and that is something that needs to be done. Finding doctors who are sympathetic, who might be willing to visit a prisoner, stick their neck out, be like, this is what needs to happen. Because wardens only listen to, like, legitimized medical professionals in terms of getting herbs in as, like, a thing to treat people, getting, like, better medicine, proving that it won't cost the prison too much to get them generic drugs, genetic hormones for people who are transgender. It has to be, like, a wide movement. It's a really big project to get medical justice for people. And the reason I flew into that rant, and I'm sorry if I seem crazy, is we need to get everyone on board, not just anarchists and radicals.
Also, organizing transportation for family and visitation.
Is that something? Awesome.
Yeah, I've only heard about a few programs around the U.S., mostly religious, that have actually gotten together, like rented a bus and gotten a bunch of people from, say, like L.A. to go up, you know, the distance of the state to go visit people at Crescent City up in the north where Pelican Bay is. Because that shit, like, most prisoners are poor. A lot of prisoners come from L.A. People can't necessarily afford to take time off of work and transport themselves up the state that whole distance.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, if people in these areas have their own transportation and they'd be willing to even, like, you know, get, like, a list going, and if, like, if you can, like, drive up just like one person's mother, you know, that's still one person who gets to see their mother. I'd go up every weekend and visit somebody, and like, yeah, it's not fun a lot of the times. It's really depressing, and like having pigs ask you to remove your fucking, you know, facial piercings and shit isn't fun. But guess what, it's also not fun sitting in a cage every day all day, you know. Like, that's my, where it's like, yeah, transport programs, the Panthers used to do that. Like, funding is a big problem, and it's like, where I'm from in New York, no one has vehicles, you know, but in places where people have vehicles, think about every time you drive that vehicle for some frivolous ish that you could spend driving people to and from prison. How much can, you know, can people pool their resources and rent a van? Can people, like, get, like, the doctor up there to, like, examine a prisoner or visit with a prisoner and expose what they talk about in terms of conditions, you know?
I appreciate the time. Thanks a lot.
No problem. Thank you, Bert.
Yeah, take care. And now, a musical selection. We are listening to the Greek band Argi Tou Thelos off of their brand new album, Tosi, with the first track translated as Cities. Next, we'll hear Blue Cross with We Are Outlaws from I Am Death. And lastly, we will hear Aringon Kansa by the Finnish band Nistiko, from the album Keha. Thank you. Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California. This show is brought to you by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm features organic coffee and milks, vegan sandwiches, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found online at firestormcafe.com. Have a great week.